This session, titled Myth and Folklore in Literature, is a magical conversation featuring Sarah Armstrong, Eliza Henry-Jones, Holly Ringland, and Kari Gislason.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this very special session today on myth and folklore in literature. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the lands where we meet, the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, and just acknowledge that this has always been a place of myth, storytelling and exchange, and of course imagination as well. I have three very special guests with me today, and I'll just do a very brief introduction. At the end is Holly Ringland. Holly Ringland is a writer, a storyteller and a television presenter, and her story, The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, is her second novel, which was published in October 2022 and immediately became a bestseller.
You got to give me warning, Harry, and thank you to you guys. I don't do that alone.
Next to her is Eliza Henry-Jones. Eliza Henry-Jones is an author based on a small flower farm on Wurundjeri land, and she has published five novels, most recently the book Salt and Skin. Welcome to you, Eliza. And Sarah Armstrong, hello. Sarah Armstrong has also published five novels, including Salt Rain, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award, no less, and has most recently published books for children, most recently Magic Awry. Hello to you, Sarah.
Hello.
Well, I guess it's no surprise to say that myths and folktales have always formed part of a writer's arsenal, and that writers have always responded to the stories that came before their work. You could say that all literature is, in some respects, rewriting older tales, reimagining older stories, and finding homes for characters in the past as well as the present. Very centrally to mythic storytelling, I think, is place, you know, that these stories are often connected in profound ways to country, to land, and to, in our case today, three parts of Northern Europe. We're going to travel to Wales, to the Orkneys, and to the Faroes, and to Denmark in our discussion. And I thought we could just start by bringing those places a little bit more to life. Eliza, how did you go about sort of researching this book and beginning to look for stories in the northern parts of Scotland?
Well, it was just meant to be a holiday, and I didn't even have my laptop with me, which was really unusual. And while we were there, I just fell rapturously in love with the landscape. You know, the way even that the light hits the land, the colours of the heather, the accessibility of the archaeological history, and this amazing cathedral in the capital of Orkney, Kirkwall, that I think they began constructing in 1137, so a very old building, and just the role that that cathedral played in the witch hunts, which I didn't know anything about. And, yeah, something about those islands just really dug their claws in and wouldn't leave me alone.
You speak you write in the novel about the light on the Scottish islands. It seemed to have a kind of magical spell over you, all the characters in the book that you wrote.
Absolutely. And I wrote Salt and Skin during Melbourne's lockdown, so I was contained on my farm, which is about as distinct a place as you could find from Orkney. You know, the Orkneys are quite grey, they're quite monochromatic and windswept, and there aren't that many trees, and the trees that are there are braced up with metal because it's so wild. And my little farm is quite lush and green and hilly and tree ferns and eucalypt. And so I think the light really took on this dreamlike quality, and the whole setting of this novel took on quite a dreamlike quality. And I was meant to, I know Holly as well, you were meant to go back to the Faroe Isles, and I didn't make it back to Orkney either. So I'm going back in September and I'm a little bit nervous about what I've got wrong.
You're going to fact check your own book when you get back, yeah. Had you been to the Orkneys before you took this project on?
No, I hadn't. I read Amy Liptrop's memoir, The Outrun, and I had a couple of friends that had been there, and I just decided that I had to get there, and it was just this really strong urge that I've never had with any other place. And we talked about this briefly in the green room, but I didn't realise I had any Scottish ancestry, and then my mum gave me one of those little DNA cheek swab things, and it's really dinky. You get to sign on to your online account and it tells you where all your DNA is kind of situated globally. And 50% of mine came back as the Highlands and Orkney, which was pretty wild.
Mm. And what do you read into that? I mean, do you think that there was something going on when you went back, a kind of recognition? Is that too airy-fairy to think that way?
I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty wild coincidence. Because, I've never felt drawn. And that was my first visit to the Northern Hemisphere as well. Like that, I just was like, I have to get to Orkney and I have to get to the Highlands. And, then to get those results back, it was pretty kind of made me quite chuffed, really.
Holly, your research for your book, which is set partly in Australia and Tasmania, partly in Denmark, in particular Copenhagen, and partly in the Faroe Islands, was also interrupted by COVID. Is that right? And
interrupted is a very polite right. description.
Yeah, messed up by COVID.
Yeah, my partner Sam and I were living in Manchester in the UK, and I was based between there and Australia. And we came home at the end of 2019 to have Christmas. Remember 2019, guys? and we came home at the end of 2019 and we were going to stay for a few months to make Back to Nature, the ABC TV show, where we travelled around the country. Great TV show to make when the country goes into lockdown, travelling around all the states and borders. And so we got a couple of episodes of Back to Nature filmed, and then it became clear to all of us that what we hoped might be a quick passing global crisis was not. And I had a month booked in Copenhagen and I had 3 months booked in the Faroe Islands. And it really challenged a core belief that I would have fought to the death with anyone over that I had about myself. As a writer, which is that I believed wholly that I could not write land or country that I hadn't walked on or sniffed or stood in the gale of or watched the sea or been in the sea or met locals and heard the stories from their mouths in their language. And so I found myself really sobbing as I cancelled my Airbnbs in Copenhagen and the Faroes, because I thought it meant that I was cancelling writing this book. I just really did not think that I could do this. And as I told you briefly in the green room, I got to the point where I thought I need to come up with a new idea, I need to pitch that to my publisher. And I rang her sort of once I'd reached the end of my distress and I said, I can't do this. We need to renegotiate the book contract. I can't do this. And I talked it all out with her and she listened and didn't interrupt me at all, because she's a really good and plotting kind of listener. And then she kind of made all the right noises. I was like, I can't do this. She was like, And this went on for like 20 minutes. She's so patient. And then she said, listen, let's hang up, you sleep on it, and let's talk about it tomorrow. And I don't think even an hour had passed. And then I got a text. And she didn't even send me words. She just sent me links. And the links were to things on YouTube and articles like Amy Tan, New York Times best-selling author of The Joy Luck Club, talks specifically about how she wrote places and times that she never visited herself. And this went on for about 20 minutes. Like, she just found all these women writers in the world who had written landscapes they'd never been to. I mean, her Googling skills were on point. And because we know each other well and we have this kind of relationship, my response was 3 love hearts and then this. So I accepted her belief in me and gave it a try. And I just thought about how did we I grew up in the 80s. How did we exist before we could move? You know, we had pen pals. You know, we hand wrote letters, and getting snail mail from another country was like interplanetary. So I went to Google, and I went deep into Google, and I found a Faroese novelist who took pity on my desperate 12-page email that I sent her begging for her help. And that is how I began the journey of writing. I'd been to Copenhagen for 3 days in 2014. Mm. It's where all my ancestors are from. I descend from Celtic Scandinavian folk. And I, with the combination of the kindness of a stranger and the friendship that has evolved out of that and the powers of the internet, I mean, how did the Bronte sisters do it? Like, they didn't have Google.
I think they spent a fair bit of time on the moors. Yeah. Well,
I know, but still.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, that's how I started to face what I thought I couldn't do.
And reading Holly's book, it is absolutely astonishing that you weren't on the ground there at some point, how your vocal landscape is. Those of you who have read it would agree, I'm sure.
Thank you. That's really kind, honey.
And what was it that drew you to the Faroes in particular? Because I come from a distant sort of an island. I was born in Iceland, and that has this feeling of a remoteness, isolation. And perhaps there is a sentiment there that there's a magical property to the landscape. Is that something that exists in the Faroe Islands as well, a kind of magic around the island?
As somebody who has not been there, as we all know, let me...
Sorry, yes, according to Google...
Yes, let me speak from my expertise. But from what I have learned speaking to locals, thanks to the internet, watching short films, there's this amazing South African Patreon-funded film production company called Green Renaissance, and they travel to far-flung places and find the outliers in every community. Mm. So, in the Faroes, there are more sheep than there are humans. And life there since the time that Irish monks first arrived has always been driven by the sea. Mm. What I loved about their films was they found... the men talking about feelings outside of a very traditional, stoic farming community. They found films about artists that hedge a living, making fairy tale sculptures. Knitting, the women in the Faroes are, I mean, I would never mess with their knitting skills. And these films found, like, the men that knit because it makes them feel calm, and they get really teased for it, but they do it because they love it. And this one guy was like, I knitted my jumper. And I'm like, you're going in the book, I love you. So I was drawn both to the incredible landscapes, which look like something... I mean, Peter Pan was recently filmed in the Faroes. So the landscapes of these peaks that just rise out of nowhere in the sea. But the thing that drew me the most to them was that in a swirling cauldron of lots of ideas coming together all at once, I wanted to write about above and below, the idea of as above is below. And in geography, if I started this story in Lutruwita in Tasmania about women and the sea and their relationships with seals and swans, what is the above? And I looked at my own ancestry from Denmark, and then I had a very, you guys will be able to tell, I was really calm on the day I was on Google in my office, and I found a photo of a sculpture in a place called the Faroe Islands of a 13-foot Selkie woman rising from black basalt rock, holding her seal skin in one hand and her human foot stepping on the rock in the other. I was home alone. I was that woman home alone screaming, like, in her office as I put these ideas together in my pants, because that's the glamour of the writing life for me.
Yeah. Actually, you do a good job selling it. It sounds wonderful. It sounds like a wonderful moment.
Here's the ad, everyone. Yeah.
Sarah, your book takes place over not only sort of two locations, but sort of two universes. It has a setting in I guess, the real world.
Mullumbimby, actually.
Mullumbimby, yeah. How real is Mullumbimby, by the way? It's not what I've heard.
Mullumbimby is very real. And I called it Malimba in the book because I had to move a mountain and I didn't want all the Mullumbimbians to come and give me a hard time about, you know, getting something in the wrong place. Yes, it starts in Mullumbimby. So there's two books. It's a duology. I didn't even know that was a word until I had a duology. And the first book has more time in Mullumbimby, but some time in a parallel universe, Wales, and then the second book the same. I have always written about Mullum. I mean, I live in Mullum. Every one of my books, the three adult books as well, is in Mullum, and I think that's just because this landscape speaks to me so powerfully. It's like a character in my books, it feels to me. And as for the Wales bit, it was a bit of a route finding myself there because I didn't start thinking, oh, I'm going to write this book that's partly set in Mullum and partly set in Wales. It was more I knew I wanted to write a book about a girl or a matrilineal line of magic, and I knew that I wanted the energy for that magic to be borrowed from nature. Because I knew I wanted to write about our interconnectedness with nature. That was sort of the starting point. And then I realised I needed to sort of find a lineage for that magic. And it couldn't come from Australia because that would be like First Nations, which I'm not qualified to write about. So I went sort of back to my ancestry, to Britain. And so that's then partway into the book I discovered, oh, okay, it's going to be over there. And I chose Wales because I had to find a language for the spells. You know, when you write about magic, you get to write spells. It's this fabulous thing. I've only ever written realism before, and writing fantasy is just, like, awesome. You world build, you create this whole world and all the rules of it, but then you actually have to follow the rules. And sometimes I'll make these rules and I'll write them in the manuscript. Then I'll want something to happen. I'm like, no, that can't happen because I've already made the rule that, you know, means that can't happen. So I was thinking about the language and I realised it was sort of so many magic spells are written like in Latin or a quasi-Latin, and I'm thinking of Harry Potter, for instance. Mm-hmm. That would be bonkers because this is this matrilineal magic is like Celtic magic and, you know, predates Roman invasion of Britain, you know. And what they would have been speaking then is, I think, something called Common Brittonic, but Welsh still has elements of that. And I thought, okay, it's going to be Welsh, and there's a bit of Welsh in my family. So that's how I landed on Wales and Welsh. And, yeah, I was also writing this in COVID. I'm not sure I could have actually afforded to go to Wales anyway, given I was just sort of writing a kid's book sort of with the hopes that a publisher might take it. I didn't have a contract at that point. But even if I could go there, I wasn't able to. But, you know, powers of Google. Like, I found a woman in Wales, Ellen Meek. She's a kids author and a translator, and she has been incredible. She lives in Swansea in the south, but knows Wales incredibly well. And she translated all my spells for me. We talked about where it would be set, and she read everything I wrote and picked up on things that were, you know, not accurate or made suggestions. And I just did things like, okay, it's this town, even though I would call it something else. And I'd go, I wonder what the road between there and there looks like. Googled it. There are motorbike riders in Wales who film riding between one town and the next. So I just watched a YouTube clip of these guys riding a bike between that town, which my story was set in, and that town where they were making a road trip to. So
there's no limit to the nerdiness of the internet, right?
Not no. The geeks will save us all.
You had a similar experience, I think, didn't you, Holly, with flights?
Yeah, flights. The catching the flight from Copenhagen to Vejar in the Faroes. I mean, plane guy 73, he saved my life. Like, I got on board with him. I listened to the Faroese staff. I knew that he ate peanuts. I'm like, Esther got on the plane and had some warm peanuts, you know. And then once she got off and figuring out the bus trip from the airport into Tórshavn, the capital, I'm watching a YouTube video as if I'm on the bus and they're like, we're going through a big spell of darkness. I'm like, Esther rested her head in the spell of darkness on the bus. But I think my favourite is, you know, you can catch the Faroes are quite famous for their tunnels that interconnect all the islands. Mm. And you can also catch ferries. They're very proud of the tunnels. They are world-class tunnels. Mm. World-class tunnels and high-speed Wi-Fi, top tips. But the thing that I really wanted to know is that there's a really pivotal moment in Esther's story where she's in the Faroes and she finally gets to this sculpture of the Selkie woman. And I had, not knowing it myself, it just feels a little bit like you're snowblind, is how it feels to me. It's like I know where I want to go, but I have no visual to help me. So these people that upload their videos to the internet thinking, oh, I don't know who will ever watch this, I don't know if this will ever be important. Universal declaration of gratitude for any, and if you're ever tempted to film your travels, you guys, and put it on YouTube, there are writers in the future who are going to thank you for it, because I followed this video on the ferry, off the ferry, and it really was down to the details of, you know, Esther parked her car and walked, you know, upboard on the ferry, and some guy was like, oh my God, look at the mustard and red houses in the villages. And I was like, Esther watched the mustard and red houses in the villages. And it was at that point where I just, and I consider myself a geek, it was at that point where I just thought, God bless the nerds.
God bless the nerds.
God bless the nerds.
So when it came time to use Welsh as a language in the novel, in these two works, were you inventing your own spells?
I wrote spells in English.
Yeah.
Sent them to Ellen, who translated them into Welsh. And occasionally there'd be sort of, she'd say, well, that's not quite there's not quite a direct translation. Would you like this or this? And so we sort of brainstormed it.
So where had you gone for those spells? Are they of your own?
I made them up.
Yeah. Tell us a couple of the spells?
Oh, yeah. I could attempt to read one in Welsh for you if you like, because Ellen really, gave me a bit of a tutoring. Okay, this is the spell. So the kind of premise of this first book is, so it's for readers age like 8 and older, right? And the premise is that this girl, Tulsi, lives in a travelling circus with her mum and dad. Her mum's a magician, but a real magician. She practices big magic and they get their energy for their magic from nature. And mum accidentally disappears herself one evening, and Tulsi is the one who has to go and get her. So this is the spell that she says when she goes to get her. I'll say it in Welsh and then I'll read it in the English version. But are there any Welsh speakers here?
Just checking.
I hope not. That's all I can say. All right. Swin, boi de grim vi chrenwe, canal kudu thiagel, creme vi vid arach, keme vi vid, kibi heed then win o blan. And then in English, may the power enter me, hold me, keep me safe. Take me to another realm. Take me where my fellow magician has been before.
Yeah. Beautiful.
It was so fun writing those spells.
You are still here.
Yes. Oh, that's a really good point. It didn't work.
is there a bit of the spell you haven't told us?
Yeah, I left a bit out. I feel like there's sort of recipe business. No, I. That of course I should be in a parallel universe right now. But I'm not. And it would be the parallel universe of the life I would have lived. In a parallel universe, it always interested me. Like, I think from about 7, it was just like I was obsessed with them, read everything about them, contemplated them. Because it's that age of life, isn't it, when your life is just beginning to open up and you sense that sort of ocean of possibility in front of you. And it's like the choices. I think I had a moment of just realising the choices I make in the next few years or even the next few days, but like, it's going to set the course of my life. And that idea that if I'd made a different choice at a particular moment, that my life would have headed in a completely other direction. Just, I don't know, it was just preoccupied me, not in a negative way, just in a sort of wondrous way. And I knew I wanted to write a novel with parallel universes. And after my last adult novel, I sort of had an idea of an adult novel. It was about domestic abuse and involved parallel universes, but I just couldn't keep writing. It was too hard for me to write, and I thought, I'm going to write a kid's book with parallel universes, and it was so fun.
Yeah. Eliza, when you were in the Orkneys, is that when you first came across the idea of a Selkie, or had that been something that you were interested in before, this figure of the Selkie?
Well, I thought that was kind of
where that idea emerged from, but then my four-year-old had COVID and I was desperately trawling through all the streaming services trying to find things to keep him occupied. And I stumbled upon this movie called The Selkie that came out in like 2001 or something. And I suddenly had this vivid recollection of just getting it out every week from Blockbuster and watching this movie on repeat. And it's not a terribly brilliant movie, but it's this Australian boy with Scottish heritage and he gets the webbed fingers and it's about him grappling with that part of himself. He turns into a seal and there's a pretty girl he's trying to impress and, you know, crooks doing dodgy things in the ocean and nets and all that sort of thing. And I'd completely forgotten about it until I stumbled upon it in a delirious caring for tiny, grumpy, snotty human moment. And so I think it's actually an idea that's been lingering in the back of my mind for a very, very long time.
Can you help us to understand what a Selkie is?
Oh yeah, context is helpful, isn't it? Selkie, they're kind of these folkloric tales that originate in areas like Orkney, like the Northern Isles, certain regions of Ireland. And in these tales, there's these people that take the form of a grey fur seal when they're in the ocean, and then they're often women, and then they'll emerge onto the shore and shed their skin and dance in the moonlight. And a lot of these tales are quite sad. Often there'll be a man who comes and steals her skin and traps her on the land and into servitude and domestic life. And in some of the tales, she's unable to speak. In most of the tales, she'll eventually stumble upon her skin, you know, dusty and tucked away somewhere, and she'll return to the sea and leave her children. So they're quite fascinating stories. And I was really interested in this particular Orcadian tale called The Selkie of Sul Skerry, and that's a very rare example of when it's actually a male seal person.
What was it about the figure of the Selkie that you found, you know, interesting as a writer?
I think I'm very preoccupied with liminal spaces, and the Selkie stories are just such an amazing example of these tales that exist between the human and the non-human world, and, you know, just even the shoreline between the ocean and the land. And there's something just so richly narrative about those stories, and I wanted to have a teenage boy who's very full of rage and kind of subverts some of those traditional Selkie ideas, and, you know, a boy who doesn't actually know where he's come from. And my book looks quite a lot at climate change, and I was interested in how these very old tales can feed into and the vital role that they can play in the things that we're grappling with now.
And this is Theo, character in your novel.
Such an amazing character, wasn't he?
He's lovely, yeah. And a rather troubled, like, young man who has webbed fingers, yeah? Mm. And who's found, you know, mysteriously as a boy, and people don't know where he's come from or where his family are. Mm. And so he becomes a kind of a mystery in the island. In your mind, was he a Selkie? Is that how you were imagining him in your story?
Tell us the secret.
Yeah, I want to know too.
So my story is technically realist, for those that haven't read it, but I've sort of threaded in these narratives about witches and ghosts and Selkies, and there's kind of often two possible explanations. For me, he was definitely a Selkie, and that alternate narrative came quite late in the editing process, and that definitely informed how I shaped him as a character.
Yeah.
And the space he sort of inhabited. In some ways, he's embraced and nurtured by the local community, but in other ways, he's ostracized and othered, and I was quite fascinated by that and the impact it has on a young person.
Because he's both quite a magical presence in the work and also down to earth in some ways. He fights, like physically likes to get into punch-ups at the pub, and he drinks really heavily. He sort of wanders the island looking for trouble. He's both, isn't he? He's both magical and he has quite a grim life in a way.
He does, yes. Yeah. Poor Theo.
Holly, as Eliza was speaking, I was thinking about the shoreline in your work and how the characters relate to the sea. Mm. And you also looked for Selkies, I think, in your story. Mm. What did they mean to you? Was there anything there in what Eliza was saying that resonates with you and the book you've written?
Eliza and I think, could talk for 100 years about the completely coincidental crossover of our minds writing our novels at the same time. My interest in Selkies comes from, I think, my wider interest in myths and fairy tales from place, from landscapes specifically, that tell us not only about the place where the story comes from and the people that have been there, but also hold all the archetypal keys that tell us who we are. So when I first read a Selkie story, to me, in my personal reading, because we all bring our own personal perspective to things like this, I read a tale of a woman as a seal in the ocean who is wild and free in her natural being and state of being, in her nature, in the power of her joy and frivolity. And she comes to land to celebrate with her family under a full moon, and a mortal man helps himself to her seal skin, which is her identity. And everything about her that he was drawn to, her wildness, her beauty in whatever that means, her spirit, is everything that he squashes and entraps by hiding her seal skin from her and keeping her in a form that is not her natural wild identity. I recognized that feeling, and I wanted to write about those old stories that have existed for so long that tell us and show us who we are and how we feel, sometimes because those things are too hard to say ourselves. And then I discovered that, just like many other ancient stories, there are different iterations of Selkie stories. And I found a Swedish fairy tale that tell the story of a Selkie, but instead of it being seals, the story is about swans. And the swans are flying through the sky. They land by water. They take off their swan suits, and they are women, and they wash and dance and frolic in the water and rest in the sun. And someone steals one of the swan women's feather suits, and she is entrapped on land and sort of palmed off to the castle, where Prince Olaf looks at her and is like, and, you know.
What's Prince Olaf saying in that moment?
You know, whatever, like, princes that take random maidens that have been found naked in the woods think when they arrive in the castle. And the thing that really struck me about that retelling of this Selkie story as a swan story is that the longer that she stayed at the castle, every autumn or winter, because again, nature is so foundational to these myths and fairy tales from the places that they come from, she would go out and the feeling of the air, and she would, draped in her royal finery, and she would look at the sky and think, I'm forgetting something. What can't I remember? What can't I remember? And then one day she finds her swan suit, and she's out of there, and she's in the sky, and away she goes. And that spoke volumes to me. And I thought, by hook or by crook, I'm writing a novel about this.
And you ended up writing a novel that begins with a swan.
Yeah.
Your story is about sisters, I suppose. And it begins with a tragic opening, which is that Esther is 1 year on from losing her sister.
Yes.
Who has walked into the sea and not come back. Mm. And she doesn't understand how that could be. Mm. And that opens a question for the book that myths seem to have some role in solving. Is that how you saw it, that the mystery of the family relationship was part of her quest to understand these old stories?
I'm really interested from my own experience and from absorbing everybody else's experience that I can about the power that stories have in our lives. The stories that we tell ourselves, in my experience, are the keys to our freedom, and they are the shackles around our neck. Mm. They are how we survive, and they are how we can keep ourselves imprisoned. And that really, really fascinates me. So when I was writing Esther's story, I wanted to write about ambiguous loss, grief that we never get closure to. But I also wanted to write about the story of how when we numb ourselves to grief, we don't realise that we're numbing ourselves to feeling the full depth and potential and power to transform our lives that joy has. So I sat down, sort of much like you were saying, Sarah, I sat down after writing The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart and I was like, okay, I want to write about joy. Here's the happy book. And then I and then I realised really quickly that the way that we know anything about anything as humans is contrast. I don't know what joy is unless I know what grief is. And the line between the two is so thin and they are inextricably entwined. And so here I was writing Esther driving home after the last time her sister was seen a year ago was walking near the sea. And Esther's driving home from the west coast of the island where she has self-exiled. And she's coming home because her parents have thrown a memorial to celebrate her sister's life. And all Esther wants to do is be in the filth of her grief, the darkness, the cave of it. And her parents have insisted on throwing an 80s fancy dress party for the memorial of Aura. So in the opening pages, and this is the only spoiler, in the opening pages, Esther is driving home and a black swan falls out of the sky and writes her car off. It goes through the windscreen. And in the shock of that moment, Esther looks up and Tita Turner is tottering towards her in high heels over gravel to help her out. So right from the outset, joy and grief are present. She just can't see it.
I was yeah. How lovely.
I'll pay you later, you guys.
Another kind of common point between Eliza and Holly's books is, I guess, drinking. There's a bit of,
not autobiographical at all. Mm-mm.
Theo's drinking a lot, and so is Esther. Like she is drinking every night and waking up with a sore head a lot. You wanted to show her, I supposed, as this, is it this combination again that magic is always partly in another world and partly in the mundane, you know? The
for sure. So a similarity between both of my novels is that even when I think I'm sort of totally open to the process, when it gets down to it and I'm writing it and then I have submitted the manuscript to Catherine who I described before, I feel like I've gone in there and I've wrung myself dry. And when Catherine read the first draft of Esther, when she goes back to the West Coast after she's had quite an epiphany of an experience with her parents and they have presented her with information that she didn't know about her sister and they've said to her, you have to go to Copenhagen. You need to go and retrace your sister's steps because her sister had been living there. Aura goes, she gets this information, it's new information. She can feel a little bit of growth rising, but she goes back to the West Coast where she's living a half-life in a staff house, in a hospitality job, where the cycle is 12-hour split shifts and then drinking bourbon and partying for the rest of time. And Kath, the first draft, I didn't have a lot of what that felt like in there because I don't want to go back to my 20s and remember that. And Catherine was like, she rang me and I said, everything all right? And she was reading the manuscript. So I was like, everything all right? And she just was like, And she said to me, you need to go back and really remember what it felt like to be in this cycle. And I'm like, I don't want to. And yet there's that great quote about insanity, right? Insanity is you do the same thing over and over again and you expect a different outcome. And that is how I lived most of my 20s, thinking that, you know, if I just kept on choosing the same guy in a different form and vodka raspberry shots after work were going to bring enlightenment.
And it wasn't working.
No, it wasn't working, but there's the magic in the mundane is that all the time in the errors and the hangovers and the moments, the magic is always there pulsing, going, you're going to notice now?
Yeah.
Are you going to notice now? Your choice is now. Are you going to make it? Or, okay, you're going to ignore us? Okay, we'll just wait. We'll wait for the next hangover.
Sarah, your book is called Magic Awry. And so, in a way, the mystery or the question that begins your novel is why magic is starting to go wrong and things are not working. Why did you choose to, in a sense, begin with a troubled magic or a magic that's starting to fail the characters?
Well, I get because it's part of a series, I guess, I mean, some people come to the second book in a series first, but the expectation is they'll read the first one where magic is solid and the only thing my character has to solve is the fact her mother has disappeared herself, saying that spell I badly read in Welsh earlier. But in Magic Awry, you know, life is good. I mean, because you've got to have trouble. But, I mean, kids' stories, there's got to be a problem pretty soon. I mean, it's kind of a fundamental of any narrative, isn't it? Any classic narrative, but even perhaps more so in kids' stories. And the other thing about kids' stories is the kids, you need to get rid of adults. I mean, think of how often there are, you know, kids are orphaned or something happens to the adults and they can't be with the child. That's because kids' stories are all about the child having agency and discovering themselves. And so in Magic Awry, my main character, Tulsi, which is the name of an amazing herb or plant, a magical herb, she is led to believe that she is the one who can solve this thing. Something is going wrong with magic and they don't really understand why, but she's led to believe she's the one who can solve it. So, I mean, I started with that just to, you know, bit of narrative tension straight up and give her a quest to embark upon.
And the awryness has a connection to other problems.
Yeah, so because my sort of the fundamental tenet of this magic, as I have created it because I have, you know, invented it, not that I really have invented this, is something many people believe and hold dear, but as I've this version of it I've created is that these magicians, they really, these magicians, and particularly the ones back in Wales and England, so on, they're the herbalists, they're the midwives, they're the healers, they're, you know, the women who were persecuted and executed as witches, basically, in eras past. So I knew that, those women are deeply connected to nature, right? And I knew I wanted this magic to be connected to nature, and the antagonist, who is a relative of my main characters, or a version of a relative, because remember we're talking parallel universes, so we have, you know, characters in same character in both universes, is sending magic awry. And I won't sort of go into heaps of detail because, you know, spoiler, but it impacts on nature because there is this notion of the interconnectedness between people and nature, and the magicians in particular work to protect nature and do all sorts of things, both magical and very sort of mundane, to protect nature. And when they start to get challenged, when things are going wrong for them, things begin to go wrong for nature too. So it's, you know, the web is a great motif throughout the book, notion of the web existing between us all. And I guess it's just sort of something, in order to absorb the energy, the magicians have to really listen to nature. They've got to spend time in nature. And by listening, it's like really being with nature. And I guess I just, you know, if we are going to save this planet, I think it's like we need to focus as much on nature right here in our backyard and as much as worrying about what's happening, say, in the Amazon. So I just, when you're a writer, the things that concern you and fascinate you and preoccupy you and you feel impassioned about, they're the things that just end up finding their way into the book. Like, it's not like I set out particularly to write all of this, but it just appeared on the page. And I think, oh, yeah, they're all things I'm really interested in. And there are things that I would like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old readers to have delivered to them.
Eliza, I hope you won't mind if I give away just the opening of your novel, because it is such an extraordinarily dramatic one. And it's quite troubling, actually. One of the main characters, Luda, has arrived on the island, and she's a photographer who's also a climatologist or a scientist who's researching the effects of climate change on coastal regions. And she's travelling along the island with her camera ready when she sees a mother and her child, her daughter, by the beach. And she just happens to take a photograph as the cliff falls behind them and actually buries the child. And the child dies, you know, in this moment. It's an extraordinarily poignant way to start the novel. And when Luda decides to publish the photograph, because she is a photographer and she wants to highlight the effects of climate change, the island turns against her for publicizing a tragic incident on the island. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why you chose to begin with such a moment and how it ties in with these questions around climate that Sarah's also been talking about.
For me, it actually goes back to an American artist called Sally Mann, who during the 80s took these absolutely beautiful but very controversial images, photographic images of her own children. And these are images that are quite explicit. They're, you know, they're naked, they've wet the bed, they've got their, you know, face all gashed open from running into a door frame or whatever. And, you know, she took these photos, and I remember reading a long-form essay, can't for the life of me track it down now, it was many years ago, where her children were actually talking about their growing awareness of that this wasn't quite right or normal, and realizing the ramifications of their mother transgressing these boundaries and actually putting these very personal and intimate images of them into the public space. And as a new mother, I started writing this when my little boy was only a few months old. I was grappling with this idea, you know, what should I be putting of my child onto social media? And how do I navigate that? How do I find my line? How is it that all these various people have, you know, found such different lines? You know, some people I know, you wouldn't even know that they had children looking at their social media profiles. Others I know everything about their child. So I had that going on in the back of my head. And then as someone who flower farms and is very aware of the microcosm of climate change just in my day-to-day life, it was something I really wanted to write about. And, you know, what can be justified by this huge global catastrophe that we're all facing? You know, are some things still sacred? You know, does climate change justify, you know, this woman transgressing the boundaries of this child and, you know, grieving family? And, you know, the book then goes on and you discover that she's actually done it before. And she, back home in Australia, she had taken a photo of her son, who is 16 at the start of the novel. She'd taken a photo of him back home without his consent and without his knowledge. She had published it, and that image had become the focal point of climate relief efforts back home in Australia. So, you know, does climate change justify a parent transgressing the boundaries of their child like that? And I don't have any answers. I sort of view fiction as being about asking questions, but that's what I was really preoccupied with when I was working on Salt and Skin.
And Luda, to begin with, she's fairly non-repentant, isn't she, about the photo. She thinks she has a right to publish it. That's what she does. And gradually, as she becomes more and more a part of the island, I think perhaps her views change as she gets to know the people that she's living with. And the family as a whole begin to look around the island and sort of investigate its history. Mm. And they come across some evidence of witch trials that have occurred in the past. I know that from my own country of birth, that in the 17th century, the 16th century, women were often hounded if they were felt to have supernatural knowledge of some kind. And there were witchcraft trials and executions that took place in Iceland and, of course, in other places. Mm. And yet in this book, I felt that you were searching for a positive association with witchcraft and particularly with women's knowledge of magic.
Mm. So I spoke a little bit earlier about this cathedral in Kirkwall. It's a beautiful, beautiful cathedral. And when I was there, I actually saw the dungeon up high in the wall where they used to actually incarcerate these people. And in Orkney, it was 90% women, which is a rate far higher than other regions in UK and Europe. They used to incarcerate them there. And during the 16th and 17th century, you know, this hole in the wall, the base of it, the floor of it was shaped like the bottom of a champagne bottle. So in between being interrogated, which was, you know, euphemism for being tortured, they couldn't even sleep in this cell. And there were also the double hangman's ladder, so this very wide ladder. And it's a bit of folklore attached to it that one side's more worn than the other because, of course, the hangman would climb up and then down, but the condemned would only climb up. And something about it just really got in under my skin. And I think I'm really interested in how, in so many ways, we like to distance ourselves from those collective acts of violence and ostracization and that sort of thing, when actually these cycles just keep perpetuating over and over again. And I wanted to explore that and also, you know, how those patterns can be broken.
Do you think that Luda is looking for some guidance from those figures of the past?
Maybe not consciously initially, but I wanted them to be a really active presence in the narrative. And one of the things I did, bless the archivists on Orkney, they sent me through so many scans and photocopies of the old Kirk records from the cathedral. And I actually wove in some of the actual very real charges that these women were faced during the trials. So promising fruitfulness in nature and raising a procession of the dead, and how these often quite marginalised members of the community, definitely not across the board, but there was a pattern, were sort of thought to have these huge powers over, you know, the sea and the weather, and whether this community was going to have enough food to sustain itself over winter. Mm. What does that intersection look like?
Mm. Yeah.
That detail about them singing to the whales, that the ladder got into my head. I couldn't sleep after I read that because I woke up at 3 o'clock and I'm like, all the women that didn't like walk down, you know. But we're also about them being charged because they could sing the whale, you know, sing to the whale. I think there's something deeply familiar to all of us about what you've written in there, even though that's not our lived experience.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing I'll just add quickly is the site where they actually executed these women. At the time we were there, it was just this little grassy patch on a suburban street. And, you know, there were kids riding their little tricycles and people unloading their groceries. And a couple of years after we were there, they added a little sundial to actually mark the site and memorialise the people that lost their lives. But just how do you make sense of a place like that, that's a site of such horror and loss, but is also just so domestic and mundane?
Mm. Holly, you know, the novel as a form is often very focused on realism. A lot of the Western literary inheritance is focused on portraying reality and giving people a feeling for what it's like to live in our world. Mm. How do you feel that magic fits into that? Where does magic sit in the novel? And do you think about that? Do you think about, you know, where you're taking your readers with the magical elements that you bring in?
My brain's just turned into a hornet's nest and I'm like, remember everything that you want to say here. I think there's two things. One is, when I'm writing, the only thing I've learned that matters about what I'm writing is in terms of where I'm taking the reader. If I think about being read while I'm writing, I'll fall off my chair and won't write anything. But when I'm writing, if I think about whether or not I love the story that I'm writing, that's the hearth that I come back to. Because if I veer away from that and I don't love, like if I'm boring the shit out of myself while I'm writing, how could I expect anybody to be like, this is great, I just page turner. So I have to come, if I go cold inside myself, I know that I'm too tired, I maybe need to step away from the desk, I maybe need more input. Input is output. I need to feed myself things that feel magic. And the other thing, so that's what I think about, like, writing and representing life for the reader, is that something true I've learned is that if I write from that place, that's how what I write has a potential heartbeat for a reader to hear on the page. The other thing is, the three of us, I'm sitting here listening to these two brilliant women and I'm covered in goosebumps because we're all talking about elements of the same thing, which is that the magic that happens between humans as a part of nature and the rhythms that are between us, and that's the magic that I write about. So it might feel like a little bit of abracadabra. It might feel like midnight margaritas out of Alice Hoffman's Practical Magic. I mean, high, look, giving myself high compliments there. But what I'm writing about is the way that the wind feels, or what the memory that wind reminds you of, what that breeze takes you of, that travel, that a tree that you've known all your life and you go back there as a touchstone. Like in the first, when I say that, the first example that comes to my mind is there's a massive river, Red Gum, by the river at Thornfield in the Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, where Alice goes through her life to see the names of her family carved into the tree. That tree holds everything that has happened in their family, with a nod to the thousands of years of families that, you know, nature has held. And if that is not magic, I don't know what is. Like, yes, I got a text yesterday afternoon from somebody, Gemma, who I did a beautiful event with yesterday, and she said, you know, did you get to the sea? Did you have a rest? She said, I went to the ocean. It was warm. I saw whales breaching. They were so playful. Being able to be a human and stand on the sand and watch whales breaching, to me, is the magic of looking into the ancient rhythms of time. And that's the magic that I don't think I'll ever not be able to write about.
We're nearly out of time, everyone, but Sarah, I did want to ask you a little bit about writing for children after having written, I suppose, realist fiction for, literary realist fiction for adults. Children are, I suppose, if we generalise, more willing to go along perhaps with a story and its mythical, magical and supernatural elements than perhaps some adult readers are. Mm. Was that, a liberating experience to move from realism as a form to something more magically real?
Totally. I mean, I would call it like low fantasy because it's like very a real world with kind of magic swirling through it, which, you know, is actually a bit like what Holly's saying. That's actually how I sort of see things anyway. So it's actually probably quite a true representation of some of the ways I feel about the world and about magic. There are so many things we cannot fathom. There are so many things we do not understand. And so, yes, I knew I was writing fantasy, but I was also just liberated by that, absolutely, as you say. And, I've got to say, writing for kids has been, it is such a joy. It's not just all joy, because, you know, you've got to have your antagonist. And, you know, I'm addressing some tricky issues at times. You know, there's a really awful grandmother that this girl has to deal with, and there are problems. And I guess it just, for me, the joy in writing is it takes me to myself as like a 9-10-year-old reader, and that was just like my, as a reader, that was just the most joyous time in my life, because it was before teenagedom. It was when I read a book a day, and I just felt that immersion in books and story and myth and folklore, all of that. So in writing kids' books, I'm able to take myself back there in some way, and that is the great joy of it. And kid readers, getting an email from someone who says, this is my favourite book in the entire world and I love you. Like,
I have never had that email.
No. it's perfection.
Listen, that is a very happy note to conclude our discussion. Could you please thank our three wonderful speakers?
Thank you, Sari. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.